Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepańczyk. In this episode, we'll feature the second of a two-part interview with Chicago journalist Jamie Calvin and his work on news coverage of police brutality and public housing. We'll also include a selection of news about media and democracy entitled Media Minutes. But now, a selection of news headlines courtesy of The New Standard.
This is the New Standard Radio News Update for the week ending April 20th. I'm Michelle Chen. The Food and Drug Administration is asking Congress to allow it to charge drug companies fees in order to fund federal review of new prescription drug advertisements. But consumer and health advocates say the FDA review of drug ads will be tainted if the review is funded by the very companies the FDA would be charged with scrutinizing. Some critics support an outright ban on all prescription drug advertisements directed at consumers. John Pippin is an advisor to the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine and a former physician.
For the physicians, frankly, it creates a conflict of interest because we may not think it's in the patient's interest to take a drug that is new, we don't know all the side effects, and the patient says, I want it. So that's what direct-to-consumer advertising does from the point of view of the physician. It creates conflict between the patient and the doctor.
The pharmaceuticals industry spent about $4 billion on consumer advertisements in 2005. A farmworker advocacy group claimed a hard-won victory last week against a fast food giant. The Florida-based Coalition of Immokalee Workers has forced McDonald's to pay 1 cent more per pound of tomatoes used in its restaurants. That raise will be passed directly onto tomato pickers and will boost workers' wages by more than 70%. In general, farm workers remain relegated to low-wage work and are vulnerable to labor abuses. But the new agreement adds to a growing string of victories in the coalition's campaign to improve working conditions by pressuring restaurant conglomerates. In 2005, the coalition forced a similar agreement with Yum Brands, the parent company of Taco Bell. The coalition says its next target is Burger King. Taxpayer advocates are accusing Walmart of avoiding over $2 billion in state income taxes due to loopholes in tax codes that allow corporations to underreport their profits. Citizens for Tax Justice released a report this week suggesting that special corporate tax deductions have helped Walmart skirt about half of the state tax burden it would otherwise have paid over a 7-year period. The group says part of the reason for the tax break is a scheme that allows companies to set up so-called real estate investment trusts. These trusts enable Walmart and other multi-state companies to basically pay rent to themselves and then deduct that amount as dividends from their tax bill. Bob McIntyre is director of Citizens for Tax Justice.
The point of our report was to show, A, there's a lot of avoidance of state corporate taxes, and B, if you modified your state tax system so you don't let these kinds of shenanigans go on, it would probably be to the betterment of your tax revenues and your ordinary citizens.
So far, 20 states have tried to close such tax shelter loopholes by mandating that corporations report their combined income from all their subsidiaries to tax authorities. New controversy is growing over the potential safety risks of nanotechnology. The technology involves using tiny particles to make products like computer equipment and cosmetics. Some scientists say it could potentially have important uses in medicine and pollution control. But a new partnership between environmental and business interests on nanotechnology safety research has drawn sharp opposition from labor, consumer, and environmental groups. The collaboration between Environmental Defense and DuPont maps out voluntary guidelines for assessing potential dangers of nanotechnology. But critics say much tighter government oversight is needed, not voluntary industry self-regulation. Eric Pika of Friends of the Earth says further commercialization of nanotechnology should be halted until all safety risks are officially addressed.
There is a real and immediate role that the federal government, as well as international governmental bodies, can play on nanotechnology. The laws that we currently have are unable to deal with nanotechnology, given the size and scale of the technology and nanoparticles themselves.
Recent research shows that it is still unclear whether nanotechnology poses a health risk to workers or to consumers, or might lead to harmful environmental contamination. We regret to inform our listeners that this will be the last edition of TNS Radio. Thank you for listening and for your support. The New Standard is a 100% reader-funded, independent hard news website. To read full coverage of these stories and more by TNS journalists, go to newstandardnews.net.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
One of the foundations of a free press in America is its postal system, where access to the mails is provided in a fair and equitable manner. Historically speaking, the federal government has, for the last 215 years, offered reduced postal rates to newspapers and magazines in order to encourage the diffusion of ideas across the country. But now this is about to change. The U.S. Postal Rate Commission has proposed a radical revision to the rate structure for periodicals sent through the mail. The plan was drafted by Time Warner, the largest magazine publisher in the nation. Under the new rules, small independent publishers will face drastic rate hikes, as much as 30%, so much that many independent magazines will simply not be able to use the mail to distribute anymore, and several may go out of business as a result. Meanwhile, the largest circulation magazines are looking at postal rate increases of less than 10%. The new rate structure is set to take effect on July 15th, and if it is implemented, every small or mid-sized publisher, regardless of what their content or political perspective may be, will suffer. Fortunately, this is not a done deal just yet. You can contact the Postal Rate Commission directly by visiting www.stoppostalratehikes.com to learn more about the issue and send a letter to the PRC with your thoughts. And there's already been enough outcry across the independent publishing world that Congress may soon hold a hearing looking into the scheme.
Broadband internet users, beware. If you decide to cut your connection or change providers, you may find yourself with a case of sticker shock. Bob Williams, director of the Consumers Union's HearUsNow.org website, says phone and cable companies have begun assessing early termination fees on customers who decide to drop or change their service provider.
It appears to be coming over from the cell phone industry. They get you into long-term contracts and they keep you there by including in the contracts these early termination penalties, which can be, we found them in the case of broadband, up to $200.
Such practices have been very successful at intimidating cell phone customers into keeping services they may not want or like.
We've done surveys at Consumer Reports that as many as half the folks that we surveyed said that they did not change their cell phone provider because of these penalties.
But at least with regard to cell phones, there's a semblance of competition between providers. Not so in the world of broadband, where the majority of Americans only have access to one or two choices, the phone or cable company. This leads Williams to believe that such penalties are more about profiteering than customer retention.
I don't think the companies worry all that much that there's going to be a lot of consumer backlash because there aren't all that many providers out there. And it's not like the consumers can vote with their feet anyway.
He suggests people press the issue directly with their broadband provider and don't back down until you get a straight answer.
You have to force them to give you something in writing, and then you have to read the fine print. And don't listen to the salesperson. I'm not going to say they would lie to you, but they might not tell you the complete truth. Their idea is to get you sold and signed up. You really have to look out for yourself.
For an overview of major broadband service providers and their early termination penalty policies, visit the Consumers Union's Hear Us Now blog at hearusnow.org.
When the Federal Communications Commission holds its fourth public hearing on media ownership in Tampa, Florida on Monday, April 30th, it'll have a good example of local consolidation to chew on. In Tampa, one company, Virginia-based Media General, owns both the daily newspaper, the Tampa Tribune, and a local TV station, NBC affiliate WFLA Channel 8. The company says such cross-ownership helps it better utilize the resources of both properties, which results in synergy that's good for both readers and viewers. Now, just in time for the FCC's upcoming hearing, Media General's announced it's laying off 70 staff from the Tampa Tribune, doing away with several neighborhood editions of the paper in the process. The company's already gone to great lengths to cheapen the TV side of its operation. 4 years ago, WFLA came under fire for allowing advertisers to buy whole segments of its morning show for the low, low price of $2,500 per segment. And TV critics on the Tampa Tribune were pressured by management not to write about the deal. deals for more than a year after they began. To learn more about this and the upcoming hearing in Tampa, visit www.stopbigmedia.com. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We now feature the second of a two-part interview with Chicago journalist Jamie Calvin and his work on news coverage of police brutality and public housing. The following interview was recorded on Sunday, April 15th, 2007. If I could follow up on one particular point that you had raised in the course of your remarks, you had referred to what is called the Plan for Transformation. I'm presuming that refers to details pertaining to urban planning within Chicago. But this broadcast, besides airing on Chicago radio, will also be broadcast on the internet and can reach a fairly international audience who may not know what the Plan for Transformation is. Could you talk a little bit about what that is?
I very much appreciate the question. I'm glad to clarify. The Plan for Transformation is the name that the City of Chicago and the Chicago Public Housing Authority has given to initially a 10 and now a 15-year plan, but we're deep into it, for quote-unquote transforming Chicago public housing. As some of your listeners may know, Chicago has a large amount of public housing, a huge concentration of public housing on the south side, which until its recent demolition was widely described as the biggest concentration of public housing and the biggest concentration of poverty in the country. So the city has undertaken, and these are, one other thing just to give a sense of the geography is, and it's one of the kind of odd and anomalous things about American cities, is that the public housing, the concentrations of public housing have been in the central city, on the south side and on the west side for the most part, on land that has become extremely attractive for middle class and sort of upscale development. So in the name of, all the rationales of the Plan for Transformation are to better the conditions and all of people living in public housing, with those kinds of public rationales, there has been massive land clearance and a very significant restructuring of the central city of Chicago on land traditionally and until recently occupied by its poorest, largely African American citizens. On the land expanse where the public housing originally was will now be built so-called mixed-income communities, which is, again, the words sound good in terms of a desire to break down sort of isolated concentrations of poverty and kind of recreate income mix in American cities. In practice, unfortunately, it's really just proved to be, thus far, maybe things will change at some point, but it's proved to be a federally funded project of gentrification. So there's been huge displacement. People who had various strategies for surviving and supporting each other in these kind of abandoned communities have now been scattered to the four winds. And we're being asked in Chicago to celebrate the building of kind of new townhouses and new developments as a kind of progress in terms of what public housing is. I think, on the contrary, it's really been a almost complete evacuation of moral responsibility to house and treat as neighbors and fellow citizens the poorest residents of the city.
And with the, I guess as of this weekend, we're being interviewed on April 15, 2007. The announcement had come down this weekend that that Chicago has been awarded by the U.S. Olympic Committee as the representative for the United States for the 2016 Summer Olympics. How do you anticipate, this may be too soon to know, but do you expect, or in what ways do you expect, should Chicago win the Olympics in 2016, that this would affect these larger trends?
Very good question. I don't really have a fully formed answer to it. I've been, like everybody else in Chicago, kind of just waiting to see what would transpire. But I have to say, with great hopes that Chicago would not be selected for the Olympics, and I kind of was really filled with dread yesterday when I heard that Chicago had. I think, that part of when we're, maybe one way of thinking about it is to look at, Beijing right now. In China, there's this huge, ruthless elimination of traditional neighborhoods. Part of it rationalized by the Olympics. I mean, I think it becomes, I think from a development point of view, preparing for the Olympics would become a sort of moral imperative for the power structure that would rationalize almost anything, as far as restructuring the city, disappearing populations of poor people, draconian security measures. I very much hope the city is not selected. We have enough problems without dealing with that one.
If I could follow up on another point that you had mentioned earlier in the interview, you had talked about founding The View from the Ground as an initiative to give coverage to stories that tend to be undercovered or not covered at all. What are your thoughts regarding the media in Chicago and the media nationwide regarding the coverage or lack thereof of issues pertaining to police brutality, public housing, and issues of that sort? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I actually think it's a really good question, and it's been sort of emerged as my life work, at least in the last decade, to try to exemplify what another sort of reporting would look like than what we get from day to day. I think if you asked not reporters so much, but editors and senior people at the Tribune and the Sun-Times, the two major dailies in Chicago, about their coverage of police corruption, say, I think they would genuinely think they do a really good job of covering it. I think if you, if you would ask similarly about their coverage of the, and I was recently quoted challenging the Tribune in this regard in terms of its coverage of public housing and the transformation of public housing, and the editor of the Tribune felt the need to angrily respond and list a whole bunch of stories that they had done over the last 5 or 6 years, and I also, in terms of journalistic colleagues, there are all sorts of good reporters who are trying to do good stories and occasionally get them in. I mean, in the most repressive regime, there are always going to be, there always have been, writers who somehow find a way of swimming upstream and doing good work. I think what's striking is the complete absence of any real institutional commitment to reporting from the ground in these communities. I haven't actually done a full content analysis yet, but let's just take the one piece of your question, the issue of reporting on police practices in inner city communities and on the wildly uneven enforcement of narcotics laws. I would venture that something on the order of 75 to 80% of the stories that appear, in that category in the daily papers are press releases from the police. Tomorrow or the next day, if you open the Tribune or the Sun-Times, there'll be a story that these police drug operations always have names. So, Operation Desert Storm shut down an open air drug market in the Austin neighborhood or the, Gresham neighborhood. So many people were arrested. We seized so many kilos of drugs. There's scarcely ever any reporting from the the ground in that neighborhood. Nobody goes down to talk to residents. Nobody has the relationships to do it. Nobody's invested the time on the ground to build those relationships to find out how Operation Desert Storm played out in the Austin neighborhood, what really happened. That's the kind of reporting that we have tried to do from Stateway Gardens and other public housing developments. And I'm not claiming for a moment that the view from the ground, so-called, is the only perspective, but it's a necessary perspective, and its absence from our public discourse and our ongoing reporting distorts everything else. It's inconceivable that, given current journalistic practices, that any reporter for the major media in Chicago would have reported the Diane Bond case or other such incidents, because they're not in contact with people in these communities on the ground. I mean, a kid gets shot, and they'll come down and do these kind of hackneyed stories about the grief of the family and the community. A police officer gets indicted for abusive behavior, they'll report on the trial. Every cub reporter knows how to report on a legal proceeding. It's an inherent sort of drama with two sides and a clear outcome. But the kind of, if you believe as I do, and I think lots of people who are deeply involved, including developers and service providers and people who are involved from day to day in inner city urban communities in America, if you believe, as many of us do, that the war on drugs has been conducted, has really been a war on these communities. I mean, has done tremendous damage to individuals, families, communities, public institutions. That's a huge story. I mean, that's one of the large stories of our time, and it goes largely unreported. And to the extent that it's reported, it's a matter of kind of reporting the stories people already know, as opposed to real, sustained, and serious journalistic inquiry.
And to continue on discussion of, I guess, larger themes and larger trends, what do you see as the trajectory of efforts to try to address matters pertaining to police brutality and public housing? Do you think that more people are getting involved? Are things getting better, worse? What's your take?
Well, I think I would just rephrase the question and not make it specific to public housing, but more generally in Chicago, I think there is, I mean, those of us working on this issue feel like we're gaining a degree of traction right now, and that there are possibilities for change. To be clear, this system, I mean, the reason for hope, ironically, for meaningful change, is that the system is so crippled, and so, the kind of representation by the city of its internal practices is so, just so false, that if there were political will to do it, it could easily be, withdraw the word easily, but if there were political will to really reform the system, dramatic improvements are possible. And this is not an abstract bureaucratic thing. Every day people are hurt, terrorized, falsely accused of crimes, because of the absence of very kind of simple but competent supervisory and monitoring processes. So when we talk about police accountability and reform, we're really talking about preventing human rights abuses, some of them, reaching the dimensions and the gravity of torture that will otherwise occur. And every day we don't address these problems, these sorts of abuses occur. I want to be clear, something else I would like to come back to, which is that one of the sort of striking features of police abuse, and something that I had to learn over time, and it's been kind of a revelation for me, is that it's really a relatively small number of officers, maybe 5% of the force, who are responsible for the vast preponderance of abuse complaints. And, you know, think about it. That's a different problem. If every other police officer occasionally abused a citizen, you know, that would be one kind of problem. You'd have issues that related to the entire kind of culture of the police department. The reality is that something on the order of 5% of the police department abuse citizens over and over again, all the time. And so this is a highly patterned form of crime, highly patterned and concentrated. And the police department has all the means at its disposal to discern those patterns. It does no pattern analysis. It doesn't connect the dots. It puts a great deal of energy into not knowing things that it has the capacity to know about patterns of corruption and human rights abuses against citizens. So, you know, if there were political will, that's something that could quite readily be fixed. It's not a technological issue. You don't need some state-of-the-art computer system. I mean, you know, there's talk of putting GPS, sort of these spatial monitoring devices in police cars. They are installing video cameras in police cars so that, you know, encounters on the street and interrogations on the street are filmed. You know, those are perhaps good things to do and useful things to do, but the fundamental stuff that needs to be done in terms of closely supervising officers, looking for patterns of misconduct, you could do with index cards. You know, you could do with index cards and could have done at any time in the last 20, 30 years. So the real issue is political will. If there is that kind of leadership, there will be really significant improvements. We've seen a lot of evidence of the capacity of the administration in Chicago to deflect those sorts of reform efforts or to go through the motions of reform without really achieving meaningful change. So I think the biggest lesson from the past is that it's important that citizens keep the pressure on. There have been some changes over time, but only when there has been significant pressure and public exposure, when the press has been on top of these stories, when the issues of misconduct have had political consequences. I hope we're entering into an era like that now, and that for a period there will be the possibility of pressing successfully for particular reforms.
Jamie Calvin is a Chicago journalist involved with the project called View from the Ground, online at viewfromtheground.com, and he's been talking with us on the phone in Chicago. Jamie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
That was the second of a two-part interview with Chicago journalist Jamie Calvin. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth.